In the lectures which have gone ahead, I have explained a great deal about Hoona and its nature, and have given you an outline of what I hope will come from the classwork, the groups listening to the tapes, and to others who join in, who are perhaps seasoned Hoona Research Associates, people who have read my books and who are eager to see the work grow. The healing circles are, in my opinion, one of the most important things. If we can develop healing after our own fashion, keeping away from any of the medical aspects, of course, then we will have something basic to go ahead with. Then we'll have something that will make the movement grow, to give us a reason for being outside of the reason that we have to spread the knowledge of the ancient Hoona system. As I have said in earlier lectures, the use of all of the mental faculties of man will be very important when we have healing circles. Ordinarily, we use practically nothing of our mesmeric powers, practically nothing of the hypnotic, and very, very little of the thing which I have written about and have preferred to call self-suggestion. Others have called it auto-conditioning. And it is something very important and something that I wish to impress upon you as being a necessity. Suggestion in its various forms, as well as the mesmeric force, has been a moot subject. It hasn't been explained properly to anybody's satisfaction outside of the Hoona circles and the people who refuse to accept any explanation, be it Hoona or otherwise, have still an outside shelf of their own to sit on. To understand what suggestion is, and the fact that it is based on something akin to thought, if we will go back to the world of the animals, the birds, and all of the things below man, who depend upon the instincts to know what to do. Let us consider, for instance, a bird, or even a chicken. And it arrives, perhaps it has been hatched. If it's a chicken and we hatch it without a mother, without a father around to teach it, when it grows up, it learns to talk like a chicken. It scratches like a chicken. It does all of the things automatically. After a while, it comes time to lay eggs and then to set on the eggs. And after they're hatched, then instinct teaches the mother hen how to handle the little brood, to sit on them, to keep them warm, to scratch things for them to eat, to cluck to them, to get them to come to her when she's found a worm or anything that she thinks that the chicks can eat. The question now is, where does the instinct reside? In our very latest modern research, I read in the papers and the magazines, they have been tracing the proteins in the basic cells and have found several of the different little chemical compounds that seem each one to be able to guide and act like an instinct. It is almost incredible, and we wonder, how can a set of those proteins lodged in a cell or in a seed, say a flower seed or a wheat seed, come eventually to develop into the form of an instinct? If we say that the chemical itself will, for instance, take over and will make the bones of a new animal body, then we have to assign intelligence as well as the substance to work with, and a force, so that one chemical can work with those three elements. There's always that need for three elements, intelligence to guide the force which shapes this substance in certain ways. From Huna we have the suggestion that the little seed is surrounded by what modern science has recognized as a magnetic field, but without much magnetism, something that is quite strange, but still seems to be there, but that the old kahunas back from the early days of Egypt called a shadowy body. And the shadowy body had the characteristic of being able to expand or contract, to be large or small, to put out a thread to extend for miles and miles in telepathy, to touch some other individual, and to make tiny little thought forms and store them in the shadowy body of the individual as memories. So we may guess that the intuitions perhaps are surrounded, as we have the several chemicals, we have perhaps the Aka body in which the real intelligence lies, and the whole process goes on from the seed on through, with very much more on the invisible side than we find on the visible side. If, however, the scientists find that they can work the gene which gives the characteristics of the human being in the cell and change it, or do things by purely chemical means, we may have to find some way of explaining how they make an artificial shadowy body, or Aka body, a.k.a. the Aka body shadowy. Now to get back to our chicken. Is there? Where does the instinct live? Is it in the brain? We suppose that it is. It might be in the solar plexus. The heart seems to have its own instinctive rhythm. It knows how to beat. The lungs seem to be attached to the brain in all of us, from the chickens up to the human, so that we automatically learn how to breathe by the application of the instinct. And we naturally say, is it a set of thought forms? And if they are thought forms, who made them? And how are they planted in the brain tissue or in the centers of the nervous system of the beastie or the man or the bird or the fish, so that it teaches or instructs and also commands that animal to obey that instinctive set of orders? At this point, we have nothing better to offer than the old theory that there is something higher than man, a series of godlike beings which have been called nature spirits. The kahunas recognize the spirits from the lowest levels right up through the levels of men. They had spirits of men, they had spirits of men alive, spirits of men dead, and they had the spirits who were able to control the wind and the weather. They had a regular ritual and could call the sharks to come to the shore. They had a certain relation with the animals, which it all centered around totemism, the totem of the tribe, an owl, for instance, or a shark, or things of that kind. Those were animals, nature spirits, with which the tribe and its individuals had some form of connection and some form of intercourse. In the American Indian tribes, they had their totems. They had, the bear was a very powerful totem, and they appealed to the bear for healing. There was a story written in 1840 in a book which told of a man who'd been badly mauled and hurt in an accident with some animal. And the medicine man took him to his tent and went into a trance and called for the bear spirit. And when the bear spirit came, the whole tent roared and rocked. There was an awful lot of noise, as if a bear was romping around in there and making noises. Nothing came out of the tent except the tent itself was in an uproar. But after a while, the observer, who was a white man writing the story, said that the tent door opened and they found that the man who had been so very wounded was practically all healed. And the shaman or medicine man had his friends take him down to the little brook and wash him off, and he was almost as good as new. So you see, the nature spirits have a good deal of part in the traditions of healing. In Hawaii and the rest of Polynesia, it still goes on in Morea down near in Tahiti. The healing of broken bones is an art that is not quite forgotten yet. Instant healing, if you please. And we speculate as to just how that happens and if there is a nature spirit that has to do with the substance of bones and which can be called upon ritually. Then we can understand that that is part of the old shamanism, that there is something there. We don't know what it is, and at this late date, we have no way of being introduced to the nature spirits so that we can begin to use them. In the old days, they had a regular ritual of introduction. You were introduced to the spirit of the wind or the weather or the shark or something of that kind, and then you could chant the ritual prayer that had also been taught to you, and you could call that nature spirit and could request it to help you with your fishing, to show you where the schools of fish were, to help you with the healing, or to calm the weather for your canoe so you could make a journey or could get home safely. And they even told some very tall tales of the men who had belonged to the shark tribe, who, when being caught out in a big storm, could call on this shark spirit to come to their aid, and they would be sent a big shark that they could ride astride of, and if their canoe had been sunk, and would be taken ashore. Whether there's truth in that or not, I don't know, but it illustrates the totemism of which we are speaking. There's a great deal which we need to know, so much that we do not know, but in modern psychology in the last 50 years almost no progress has been made. In physiology and chemistry a little more, but we're very weak in theory, and in order to try to handle some of these things, to explain them, you might say, we have to go back to the old Huna lore and to the related lore of earlier civilizations or the remnants of the civilizations. From all outward appearance, the animal or ourselves, when we react to an instinctive urge or command or whatever it is that is lodged within us, we have all of the appearance of having a thought form planted as a supreme suggestion in the mind of the lesser self, the low self, the subconscious self, the une hipili of the Polynesians. We do not know whether it is a thought form, but if it is something planted there, something that grows up like we grow a foot, or grow hair, or grow eyebrows, something that must have been there in seed form to begin with, and which gradually has grown up into a series of complicated and connected thought forms, so that when you actualize or touch on one thought form in an instinct, it will touch off another. For instance, going back to our chicken. When she has laid her eggs and has them in a nest, which instinct has taught her to dig out or to build in some way. Birds build very complicated nests all by their use of instinct. Then that triggers the next step. The next step is to quit going around and having a good time as a hen ordinarily would, but to begin to cluck and be broody and to sit on the eggs and keep them warm. She gets hungry, she gets thirsty, and she leaves the eggs and rushes out to find a little food and water. And then instinct brings her back. She's triggering it one stage after another until finally, after her 3 weeks of setting have been complete, then she has, having been instructed to turn the eggs over with a foot every so often, the knowledge that the little chicks are hatching out. And she doesn't stomp on them, doesn't kill them. She throws the eggshells out of the nest, and in short order, she's standing outside, or she's settling down carefully among the chicks and hovering them with all of her wings. It's really quite a marvelous thing to think of what the instinct does. And if there is a chain of reactions in the way of thought forms which are charged with vital force, and that must be a charge large enough to keep it going for practically the whole lifetime of the person who reacts to the instinct, or of the animal or the beast or the bird, then that must have been an original charge that was very heavily manipulated. In writing my little book called Self-Suggestion, I started out in a preamble to tell about the use of mesmerism, and it has to do with instinct. Perhaps I can repeat it here again. I said that of all of the little beasties who had evolved, perhaps come up out of the sea, the snake was the poorest equipped of any of them. Other beasts had wings, they had hands and feet, or they had legs, and they developed a good set of teeth so they could chew things and could capture prey by their fleetness, by flying fast. They could get another bird to eat if they were a ravenous bird. But Mr. Snake, he wasn't equipped. For some reason or other, all he had was instinct. And he had the poison fangs, but he wasn't very fast on his feet. He had no feet. And to get his food, he was carnivorous. He had developed, eventually, an instinctive reaction and became our first mesmerist. He would approach as close as he could to a bird and project his mesmeric force, which instinct had taught him to use. He had it apparently as his native possession. Maybe he generated it, I don't know. But the mesmeric force fascinated the bird. They call it fascination instead of hypnosis when they're describing it in the books. And the bird would flutter helplessly, and the snake could come along at its own good time. And having no teeth except its poisoned fangs, which it didn't need in this case, it would go to work to swallow the bird whole. It was a very poorly equipped beastie, but having been given a mesmerism and the instinctive power to use it, the snake did fairly well. He managed to survive when a good many of the old dinosaurs and things like that failed to keep up with the race. We have snakes of all sorts, sizes, and descriptions, and they have been with us for a very long time, but they have still not developed the hands or the feet or the chewing teeth that they would need to handle their food. Now, when we consider the fact that man is made up of three selves, a lower animal self, which is instructed by instinct, as the animals who are all low self are instructed, and then the evolved middle self, which has the power to reason, the inductive, not the deductive reason, that is the higher form of reason, which sets it off apart and makes it able to control the low self up to a certain point. Then there is this still further evolved spirit or self, the high self, the parental, dual, father-mother spirit, which seems not to use reason, but simply to know all there is to be known about a thing by some mysterious identification with the problem or with the thing itself. The psychologists have quarreled for quite a long time over the nature of instinct in man. we all agree that there is the instinct of self-preservation, that when you're faced with a danger, you automatically try to save yourself. Others agree that the instinct of sex is a strong insect. Then there's the reaction to hunger and to thirst, the need for comfort of keeping ourselves warm, and the need to keep breathing. We seem instinctively to react in a violent way if water surrounds us, or if we are choked, or anything stops the breathing. Then in centers of the body, we may have instinct in the rhythmic beating of the heart. The stomach acts to digest the food. The whole of the interior man, under what we postulate to be the low self or subconscious rule, and the rule and the help of the instincts, forms a world of itself, a background world. The best theory or explanation at the present time seems to be that there are lodged in the low self part of the brain a series of what you might call connected or chain-linked thought forms, which grow up with us as we grow up from the embryo, and that these instincts begin to take effect as we go along and as we grow and stay with us all through our lifetimes. Just what the location there of the thought forms, if they are thought forms, maybe we don't know. But it's easier to think of them being located in the memory bank of the subconscious than it is to think of them as a general chemical reaction. We know that there are chemical reactions along nerve centers and so on. One chemical will release the one next to it, and a nervous reaction comes along. But on the general line of things, perhaps the instinct and the thought form is the best for our theoretic purpose. We have further evidence that there must be thought forms embodying the instinct in animal as well as in man, for the reason that we can change those instinctive reactions by teaching ourselves, our animals, a different set of reaction. Instead of reacting to the ordinary call in some way of the instinct, we can train an animal to react in a different way. And so there we say we have put a different set of thought forms containing a different reaction pattern into the low self of the animal, who is, as I have said, all low self, or into ourselves, and we must have our low self as well. And this brings up a very important point. If we find one set of thought forms can overpower or replace another set of thought forms which are resident in the instinct, then we have discovered something that we can put to use. If we do not like a habitual reaction that we have made, not inherited, for instance, the habit of smoking, none of us are instinctively taught to smoke. That's a very foreign activity. And we teach it to ourselves, and we make a habit which is almost as strong as the habit of self-preservation. It's one of those things that I don't need to argue about. If you have ever been a smoker and have given up smoking, you will know that it's a very powerful set of thought forms which are behind the habit. But if you can replace those gradually or at one fell swoop with a different set of thought forms which can replace or overpower the thought form which brings on the chain reaction of wishing to smoke, getting a cigarette out, lighting it, and smoking, then you have demonstrated again the fact that there are thought forms in the interior of the low self, which can be worked on and manipulated. And that is the important point of what I am getting around to by my slow approach. Some investigators, beginning from the early days, who have been eager to know just what goes on when we use the instinct, or when we break a habit, or when we do anything in the way of our ordinary mental changes, have come to the peculiar conclusion that with the inherited instincts, we have then the instincts which are artificial. In other words, they call everything that we have learned. We learn to walk. We learn to go to bed at night. We learn to eat. We learn to talk. We learn a great many things which you might say are artificial instincts. We pick up a newspaper. We have learned to read, and we have no hesitation any more than the bird has when it starts to carry the straw to the tree to make its nest. We read. And they have come to the conclusion, after watching the way people act and do not act, that most of us are hypnotized by the thought forms or memories of all of the things that we have learned, our artificial instincts. And as the man changes these, he gets one thing after another stuck in his craw, and there may be a conflict so that one suggestion counteracts the other. And if he's at war with himself, that is, his instincts, artificial, and the ones he has inherited are at war, then perhaps he becomes ill, mentally ill, physically ill, has bodily ills, the psychosomatic troubles. It is, of course, difficult for any of us to realize that we have anything like an instinct working in us, or that we are reacting to habit forms, or that we might be influenced adversely, badly, by some of the things that we have learned from our environment, some of the habits that we have learned, like the smoking, the drinking, the talking too loud, the manipulation of the various things around us in a way that doesn't do us credit. In counseling work, if you study a person and you say to that person, now you've developed a bad habit here of doing so-and-so, and the person say, no, you're wrong. I haven't any habit. When I speak loud like that, it's because so-and-so and so-and-so. Which reminds me of the story of the two Quakers. And the Quaker man said, sometimes, dear wife, I think that thee is a little queer. And she said, ah, yes, but my dear, I think that thee are queerest in thinking that I am a little queer. So we have all of the difficulty of trying to understand ourselves. Someplace we hear the motto repeated. Some say it was written on the forehead of the Sphinx. Man, know thyself. It appears in the Greek. And to know ourselves, we certainly need to know what the memory, instinctive part of our mental capacity is. What it is that moves us without our thinking, the instinctive reaction, such as we see with the habit, we react instinctively to the good habits. We walk with the habit of a chain reaction. We talk, we read, we write, we do many things. But the things that we don't find good in ourselves should also be considered. And that is why we need the use, and of course we can't use it unless we understand it, the use and the understanding of self-suggestion. We need also to understand that the low self is not the only one who is being worked over to get its thought patterns and chain reactions changed. The middle self is the one that we have to start to work on first. For instance, if we wish to start reducing by not eating quite so much, if we wish to stop smoking, any of those things, we first have to get the middle self lined up. We have to get it willing and able and anxious and determined to turn over a new leaf and to start things going in the opposite direction. But once the middle self has been brought into play and has started the ball rolling, the low self comes in for its share, and that is where the auto-conditioning or self-suggestion part comes. And in healing, that is something that we are approaching now in our little circles as a very valuable piece of experimental work. We have to learn to know how to handle ourselves with group therapy. Self-suggestion is something that we can help our neighbor to use, but perhaps we had better first learn how to use it ourselves. One of the common things that almost all of us will admit that we could improve in is our relationship with our friends. If we wish to go out and to make friends, we need to be interested in them, in what they are doing, in what they are thinking, and above all, to try to be helpful. The motto here is serve to be served, and you might change that around and say be willing to serve in order to make friends. If we will examine ourselves and try to remember what we have done the last few times that we have met strangers, whether we have been abrupt with them, whether we have been very selfish in speaking entirely of our own affairs, whether we have been helpful, whether we have given them a brush off, or whatever it is, we might find in there selfishness, a little reaction to the instinct of gimme, the instinct to grab. And that is a very common and a very animal instinct. If we are grabbing something for ourselves, or if we are trying to get some advantage for our family, or if we're trying to ward off the encroachment of somebody else who is trying to get something that we have that we're clinging to, here is a place where we can examine ourselves, where we can see what goes on beneath the surface, more or less, and perhaps we can go through the various little steps of suggestion after we have decided as a middle self what we would like to change in ourselves, and then to impress it upon the low self with the auto-conditioning methods, so that when we meet friends, we will make friends and influence people, as the phrase now goes. The first step, as I have said, in getting ready to use auto-suggestion is to decide as a middle self just what you want, and to make a mental picture. We've had the games that have been mentioned on the tapes, the games which have developed the ability to imagine, to picture something. And we need to make a picture of ourselves as we wish to be. We figure that we are going to make some change now. Perhaps it is a health change, but those things are more difficult to handle. And it is better to start with something that is a little more on the surface. A habit, even a little small habit of some kind, is a better thing to start to practice on. But we need to learn to make a thought form or a series of thought forms which will embody the mental picture, and to charge that very heavily with vital force. The old kahunas who knew more about suggestion when we look at the language and see the words they used than we do in the modern times had a word which was H-A-O. The H-A, ha, means to breathe heavily, and the O means thought. And this was their idea or their word of suggestion, one of the words that they had. In other words, you breathed heavily, which was the symbol of accumulating vital force, and O, or the thought, you charged the little thought with the vital force. A secondary meaning of that was to place a little thing in a big thing, and the little thing was the thought form, and the big thing was the man, the memory of the man. So you make your thought picture, you charge it heavily with vital force, and you have that then as a part of your memory so that you can recall it on the moment. When we have a fright in life, a very narrow escape of some sort, and it frightens us suddenly and greatly, we react with the whole strength of the instinct of self-preservation. All of the vital force that we have in the body seems to be suddenly focused and concentrated in the memory that is being made of the thing that is threatening us. This memory is highly charged with the emotion of fear and with the vital force, so that as a memory, later on in your life, you may, in your dreams, remember that and live through the same frightening experience. This fear complex, or you may have some great disappointment that makes such an impression that is charged with mana, and it will sadden you every time you think of it. The lost love, all of those things. The point is that these things are heavily charged with vital force, and that when we call them from the memory into the focus of consciousness, of the subconscious or the conscious mind, whatever that focus of consciousness is, when these things are recalled, they have such a heavy charge of vital force, of mana on them, that they cause a reaction. The reaction usually will have again, an emotional quality to it. The emotion of anger in recalling an old fight, or the emotion of fear, the emotion of hope when something was almost within the grasp, the emotion of disappointment, all of those things, and the emotion of a deep experience of faith and devotion. Those things are valuable, the good things like the devotion, to be able to recall, because they will set off a chain reaction and start a new sensation of devotion. In some cases, the impression that is made, such as the memory of fear or hope or disappointment, becomes embedded in the low self without being rationalized by the middle self. We have been told recently that things that happen to us when we're unconscious, the words that are said around us, may make a fixation. But we know that there are things called fixations, and that these may be triggered off in some way so that the subconscious reacts to them, which in a way seems to the middle self as being entirely unreasonable, because it doesn't know what the reason was behind the original event which caused the fixation to be formed as a series of thought forms with some high charge of mana on it. If it were a simple matter to discover our own fixations, our own complexes, then we could start in to resolve them by rationalizing them. We could think, well, this is a very irrational way that I have reacted to this cat that has come in. I am afraid of cats, and I have no reason for being afraid of cats. if a person has a cat phobia. And then by rationalizing it, get rid of the fixation. However, the fixation has to be matched by a series of thought forms of greater vital force charge. In other words, if you've got a big thought form, which is the basis of a fixation, you've got to get a bigger thought form in your memory so that when one comes up, the other will come up with it and will overpower it. We react to the most highly charged and strongest set of thought forms, whatever they are. And if we can get a hold of an old thought form and drain it of its vital force and change it by considering it calmly and by thinking about it, reasoning about it, that is called draining off the fixation. And that is a very important part of the work of the psychiatrist. Very often a fixation will come up in dreams, especially if you are anticipating dreams and are remembering them or are writing them down. And the psychiatrists have learned that there is sort of an instinctive form behind many dreams. And if you're dreaming about mother or father or child or things that have to do with the instinctive loves and hates and disappointments, fixation can be more or less pinpointed and can be talked out, can be drained off so that the strange reaction can be canceled. In our healing work, we will have to develop stronger ideas or sets of thought forms of health and charge those with sufficient vital force to counteract the thought forms which are now held of sickness. That's a very important point there. We have to replace the thought forms, the belief, the picture we have of ourselves with a picture of ourselves without that illness, without that defect. And for this time, my aloha.